Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for June 7th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host, the one and only Bob Bubka. Bob, we've got a lot to talk about today. You're headed to the Open Championship. It's Women's Golf Day. Tiger Woods has made a big announcement about the U.S. Open. And, of course, LIV Golf, maybe the number one topic in the sport of golf. Bob, let's start out with some great news. You are headed over to the 150th Open at St. Andrews in Scotland in July, and you're going to be part of a lot of history there with one Jack William Nicklaus.
Well, you're right about that, Kelly. I'd be lying if I didn't say Janice and I both have goosebumps over the fact that confirmation has been received that we will be covering the 150th Open Championship at St. Andrews. I've been there many times in the past, but it never gets old, I can assure you of that. Added spice this year, as you alluded to, Jack Nicklaus going to join two other people that's going to be have received basically the keys to the city of St. Andrews. Bobby Jones, which you certainly could understand, right. But Ben Franklin, who, after doing some research, discovered that he went to college at the University of St. Andrews back in 1757, and they awarded him the key to the city. Now Jack Nicklaus, on the Tuesday prior to the Open Championship, he's going to receive the key to the city. We're going to be there. Tiger's going to be there. You know, having done golf for a long, long time, I never thought my level of excitement would reach what it is right now. But it's a thrill. It's an honor. I feel very blessed, and certainly I'm looking forward to it. And we're going to be able to give firsthand accounts to Musing on Sports, and I'm very proud of that aspect.
Well, you should be. It's wonderful on all accounts, all the emotions that you just outlined. Jack, indeed, will become the third honorary citizen of St. Andrews, place where he won two of his Open championships, a place where he decided would be his last Open championship, and he pretty much had said he wasn't going to ever come back. And then they called and said, Jack, we'd like to make you an honorary citizen, and you're joining Mr. Jones and Mr. Franklin. You don't turn that one down, Bob, by the way.
No, Ben would be very upset if he found out that Jack said no.
Exactly. Well, wishing you and Janice, our executive producer, safe travels, and you're going to have so many great memories and stories coming out of that week. One player who also will be there, as you mentioned, is Tiger Woods. Made the announcement earlier today, and I'm so happy that he did, that he is foregoing the U.S. Open at the Country Club next week. He flat out said, I need to rest, need to get my body in better shape for major championship golf. He does. He labored. Yeah, he made the cut at the PGA Championship, labored when it got cold on that Saturday at Southern Hills, pulled out after that round, and I think this is a great move. You talk about, it can be cold, as you know, over there, but I think this is what he's had his sights set on. This championship at St. Andrews, where he's won before, in his mind, probably the best chance this year to win one of the four major golf championships for him.
Well, you're right on the money, Kelly. St. Andrews is certainly a ball striker's golf course, second shot golf course, and Tiger's a fine iron player as ever to have played the game. So he's looking forward to it. There's no real hills to walk up and down.
Right.
There's not a lot of uneven lies. Don't forget, Tiger made a promise to me at the PGA Championship that he was going to win another major. Mm-hmm. I would think his best opportunity to fulfill that would be a victory at St. Andrews. Wouldn't that be something in the annals of golf history? Tiger Woods wins the 150th anniversary of the Open Championship here at St. Andrews.
That would be some story. And speaking of victories, today's a victory for women in the game of golf. It's Women's Golf Day. There's a woman named Alyssa Gaudet who really spearheaded this effort. You have about 880 golf facilities worldwide that are promoting the game, welcoming women into the game, enhancing the experiences for those who are already playing the game. One of the great things, when I was at the PGA of America for about a dozen years, Bob, we talked a lot about the different aspects of the game of golf, the camaraderie, the competition, to be out there with friends and family. There's so many reasons for anybody to play the game, and certainly for women to pick it up. There are more and more who are playing the game. You saw the terrific play over the weekend, obviously at the elite level with Minji Lee, really dominating at the U.S. Women's Open. But for women who just want to get into this game, and it may be for business, it may be for fun, it may be for family, all kinds of reasons, and Women's Golf Day is a great way to celebrate that.
Yeah, and we happen to be good friends with Elisa. Matter of fact, we knew way back when it was just a dream, and she got together with Janice and I and said, you know, I have this vision that, you know, we can have a day out of the calendar year that pays tribute to female golfers. And boy, oh boy, she has worked hard. She has realized that vision. Now it's one of the outstanding dates on the golf calendar each and every year. Congratulations to Elisa on a job well done. And I know Women's Golf Day is only going to grow and get bigger and bigger.
And remember, when it comes to playing golf, it does not mean you have to play 18 holes. It means you can go and hit some golf balls on the range. It means you can go and play six holes and have dinner afterwards on a Thursday. It means you can play nine holes in a scramble with a friend, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, wife, husband. That's how you get the enjoyment of the game and get into the game and make it fun. A little different fun for Minji, the way she played. Did you see that her caddy at the U.S. Women's Open at Pine Needles was the same caddy who Corey Webb, the last Australian before Minji, he caddied for Corey Webb in 2001 when the Women's Open was played at Pine Needles. That's pretty good karma. Give me that caddy, Bob.
Yeah, he's absolutely a great caddy, and I'm glad the name Corey Webb was brought up again. She was a very good friend when we were covering LPGA events and Women's Opens, and she was extremely talented young lady, a little bit shy, but an awfully nice person, and has done wonders for the game of golf, especially women's golf, down in Australia.
First press conference today in conjunction with the LIV Golf Invitational Series, which is backed by the Saudi government. And Dustin Johnson had a line today that I think is one that you're going to hear from a lot of players who have decided to play in that. And in fact, he joins Kevin Na and some Europeans, Sergio, Louis Oosthuizen, and Charles Schwartzel, in resigning from the PGA Tour. And Dustin Johnson says, "I chose what's best for me and my family in resigning from the PGA Tour. And I think $100 million plus, Bob, in guaranteed money will certainly help you make decisions and make those kinds of choices." There's a lot of layers to this, we know, but boy, the money is just, it's just out of sight.
And I can't help but think when I hear about these resignations from the Tour, the old joke where the boss said, "You're fired," and the guy said, "You can't fire me, I quit." "No, you're fired, I quit." I mean, who knows? Resignation from the Tour. If you resign from the Tour, you can't be suspended.
That's right.
So if you can't be suspended, you can't get any penalties. I don't know. It's a big, big mess at this juncture. Is it overall good for the game of golf? I'm really not smart enough to even make that evaluation. I'm along with just about everybody else, and, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. Is it good for the PGA Tour? I cannot see any outcome that'll make this, LIV Golf being good for the PGA Tour. But still, I mean, the amount of monies that are being, given away. I mean, Phil Mickelson, they said he had some money problems with some gambling debts. Well, I'll tell you what, he just came in at $200 million. I guarantee he doesn't have any debts now, and he can't spend $200 million in his lifetime, no matter what. You know, after you buy the biggest mansion, the biggest yacht, the biggest airplane, you got a problem in spending money, and $200 million is a heck of a problem to have. I know I would like to give it a crack at making it disappear. I think Las Vegas might be one of my best friends if I came in at $200 million.
Oh, my gosh. And I agree with you, and I don't say this in a condescending way, but I don't think that LIV Golf is necessarily good for the game. I think it's good for a few players in the game who have the opportunity. The Sergio Garcias and Graham McDowells and Ian Poulter and Lee Westwood, Kevin Na, Dustin, Phil. Yeah, it's not in a way, I tell you what, you've got some names there. I know you've also got some guys, James Piatt, who won the U.S. Amateur last year, who isn't even professional yet, having just a chance to play, and you're not going to see a guy like that around because you're in the future events on LIV because they want to attract the big names. This is great for a handful of guys, and that's exactly where LIV is trying to go. You've got and Bob, again, why not? 48-player field. You've got sort of this team concept similar to Formula One. You have 12 four-man teams, 54-hole events, no cut. First seven events, $20 million purses, Bob. They played for $12 million at Memorial. Billy Horschel, who played great, won 2.1. The winner of this event this week, 54 holes, no cut, wins $4 million. Last place this week at LIV, $120,000. Last place at Memorial was about $25,000. So if the event looks good on streaming, it's not going to be on regular TV. It's going to be streaming on YouTube. It's going to be on livegolf.com. If it comes off looking good, if other players see it, I'm telling you, if a Ricky Fowler sees this, and Fowler missed the qualifying for the U.S. Open, if Bryson DeChambeau sees this, and DeChambeau was one of those guys that I think was very interested in this tour, you may see a guy or two tee it up next month when they play the first LIV event in the States in Oregon. It's going to be most interesting from the perspective of the players who Greg Norman and that group are trying to attract to play and LIV.
Well, just seconds ago from our news department here at Musings, an announcement by the USGA stating they will accept Dustin Johnson into the U.S. Open at Brookline if he wants to participate, sure, and Phil Mickelson, sure, if he wants to participate. So that is a big, major stepping stone for LIV Golf. I'm just looking at it. They play eight events with LIV. They play the four majors, assuming that the other three follow the lead example of the USGA. That's 12 events, yep, and you're making all this money. You got a lot of time with your family. You got a lot of money in the bank, and you're still playing some competitive golf. Wow. Cannot be a happy place right now down at Ponte Vedra and headquarters for the PGA Tour.
In the lead to my Monday Musings on Facebook, it's a column I write each week, my opening sentence was, work less, period, earn way more. And then I wrote, sign me up, right? And that's exactly what's going on. You're going to work maybe 12 weeks. Let's say you can work 12 weeks, Bob, and you can spend, therefore, by my calculation, that means roughly 40 weeks you don't have to work. And you're going to be making substantially more money than you would have made on the PGA Tour. And if you can put the moral, the ethical concerns that many have about the Saudi government aside, let's say that you have played in some of those events that have been held in Saudi Arabia in the past, boy, you've found yourself a pot of gold.
Let me just share with our listeners a statement made by the United States Golf Association just minutes ago. Regarding players who may choose to play in London this week, we simply asked ourselves this question. Should a player who had earned his way into the 2022 U.S. Open via our published field criteria be pulled out of the field as a result of his decision to play in another event, and we ultimately decided they should not. This is from the United States Golf Association.
Very wise to do so, in my opinion. Phil Mickelson, by winning the PGA Championship last year in South Carolina at Kiawah Island, has a 5-year exemption to play in the United States Open. Dustin Johnson winning the Masters a few years ago also gives him that 5-year exemption. So, yeah, I they earned it. And I do not think the USGA would have been in – I think they would have been way out of bounds if they had denied them the ability to play. Now, so much of this, again, when it comes to the larger issue of the PGA Tour, are these players independent contractors? Are they bound by the PGA Tour? The PGA Tour with the commissioner, Jay Monahan, has made it clear. If you join LIV, you're gone. You're done. We're going to ban you from the PGA Tour. I got to tell you, Bob, I don't know in a court of law, and it will get there. I don't know if that holds up. I think it's a delicate balancing act for the PGA Tour, and I think that's a major concern. I don't know how all this shakes out, but I don't know that you can mandate guys that if you leave our tour to go somewhere else, you can never come back and play our tour again.
No, you're right, and I just received word, confirmation on the fact that Phil Mickelson and Dustin Johnson have agreed to play in the third major of the year. So Phil, for those that may not be aware, only needs the United States Open title to complete the Grand Slam, become the sixth player in golf history to win all four majors. So that just give a major shot in the arm to the U.S. Open at Brookline. Not that I think it needs it. Brookline, right. One of the finest golf courses in the country, and the U.S. Open obviously speaks for itself. But we're going to certainly have a lot more excitement with Phil Mickelson playing, depending on how he's been performing. Now, nobody knows whether he's been practicing for the last month, whether he's not been near a golf course. A lot of questions to be answered, which I think will be answered. Hopefully he's going to have a press conference prior to the start of the LIV event in London, and we'll be able to find out from Phil firsthand what he's been up to.
Now, Bob, while the USGA has announced that those two players are welcome, when you resign from the PGA Tour, that essentially disqualifies you from competing in international competitions run by the PGA of America and the PGA Tour. Therefore, Dustin Johnson is no longer eligible to play on President's Cup teams. You've got the President's Cup at Quail Hollow in Charlotte in September of this year. He's no longer eligible to play on Ryder Cup teams. You've got the Ryder Cup outside of Rome next year. He's accepted that. And again, the courts will determine this in the long run. But I thought that when Kevin Na, he was the first to say, I'm resigning from the PGA Tour, I thought it was a stroke of genius. I thought it was a really good move for exactly those reasons. Now you're not a member of the tour anymore. So whatever court decision is made, it becomes rather nebulous as to how it affects you. But for Dustin, he's fully aware that he can't represent the United States in international competitions. But again, the money's just too good.
Yeah, and I was basically saying what I was kidding about before. You can't fire me. I quit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
it's really
boy.
True.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
You know, it's real. I think it's a seismic shift in golf. I don't know how it'll play out. I really don't. And so much has been talked and written about LIV, and it's been a long time coming. Let's be honest about it. It's been talked for quite some time. And now that it's finally here, and now that they're finally going to play an event, I'm really interested to see how it'll play out and how and what guys may determine that, wow, I love the PGA Tour, but as Dustin Johnson said again, I chose what's best for me and my family. You're going to hear that refrain from players, and not sure I can blame them. You know, we're
hey,
gonna,
Cal, before yeah, we move on, just one thing popped into my head last night. You know, been reading that it's a shotgun start.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
That means they're going to tee off on every hole that, you know, has players at the same time.
That's
what,
right.
What does TV do at that point? Where do they go?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's my understanding they have 60 cameras. That's a lot to cover to cover a single field event. But if you've got 60 cameras, you only have 48 players, you can probably get around a lot easier. I don't know exactly how the machinations of it will work. And it will be interesting also to see if, as guys are playing, you know, typically you if you're leading, you tee off late in the day and you know, you already know what's going on. Now you're kind of in the middle of things. You're playing at the same time that everybody else is. One other thing on that, Bob, the official world golf rankings for some of these players, like a guy like Hudson Swafford, a younger player, who quite honestly really hasn't done all that much on the PGA Tour, but again, is looking for a very soft landing. I mean, he's got a great life as it is, but he's looking for that, give me 12 weeks out of the year, I can work, make a lot more money, but not then get to spend the other 40 with my kids. That's fine and dandy. But the official world golf rankings are not going to give any points based on your performances on the LIV Tour. Why? Because to me, it's kind of a, I don't know, I don't mean again to be condescending, but it's somewhat of an exhibition. It's 54 holes. It's not 72 holes. And that's it. So if you win an event, you're, in terms of the world golf ranking points that would qualify you, would qualify a player for Swafford or Kevin Na, for that matter, to get into the Masters or the U.S. Open or the PGA Championship or the Open Championship. They've never won any of those. They're going to put themselves in a bit of a bind, I think, in terms of being eligible to play in major championships.
Well, I think world golf ranking points, as we know it, probably going to cease to exist. But what they'll come up with to replace it remains to be seen. I think the biggest revelation over the last couple of days, and there's been one a minute if you follow it closely enough, is the fact that it appears, certainly at this juncture, that all four majors are not going to penalize players that are playing, on the LIV tour. And I just think that's huge. You know, it's one thing. You're probably right on the President's Cup and Ryder Cup, and that's certainly tough enough to give up, but nowhere near the difficulty giving up an opportunity to earn a green jacket or win the United States Open or the Open Championship or the Wanamaker Trophy at the PGA. If they still have an ability to do that, this goes a long ways towards hurting what the PGA Tour would like to see accomplished.
One other person who has seen a lot of golf in his life, reported on major championships, reported on multiple Olympic Games. Jimmy Roberts is our guest today on Musings on Sports. And we're going to hear from Jimmy in just a minute. Bob, you and I talked with him a week or so ago. Fascinating guy and loves the game of golf. But, he told some great stories I know the listeners are absolutely going to love.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin here, along with my dear friend and co-host Bob Bubka. And Bob, what a thrill it is for us to welcome in a wonderful New York friend of yours. He's as versatile as they come in sports broadcasting, having spent a dozen years at ESPN before joining NBC Sports in 2000. You hear and you see him all the time. And we're fortunate to welcome Jimmy Roberts to Musings on Sports. Jimmy, how are you?
I'm well, Kelly, thanks. How are you guys doing?
Well, we're doing pretty well, Mr. Roberts. And I remember one of the first times that I met you, you happened to say to me, where am I from? And I said, well, I grew up on the end of Long Island, and you said, oh, I go out to Watermill quite frequently. Do you still do that?
Well, it's funny you mentioned it, Bob. So when we first met, I actually owned a home in Watermill and just off of Noyack Road, which you know well, and sold the house. And as is my luck with all things real estate, I sold it at the wrong time. But since then, have gone back to the place where I visited from my very first days going out to the East End, the Dunes in Amagansett. We go out there every summer in August, and when I don't have to be working, it's just heaven on earth as far as I'm concerned.
Amagansett, one of the garden spots on the East End. It's funny, the Hamptons, East Hampton, Southampton, even Sag Harbor gets a lot of credit, but Amagansett seems to be for the people in the know. You know, it's... Yeah. It's as good
as it gets. Don't tell anybody, Bob.
I know.
Right. Quieter the better.
Jimmy, let me ask you this. I see where there was a morning joke of the day at White Plains High School. What was that all about?
You know, I'm not really sure. So I used to do the morning announcements. And I mean, I guess this was back in prehistoric times when everybody would gather in school and, you know, they'd come on and somebody would recite the Pledge of Allegiance and all the kids would stand in their rooms. And then there would be announcements through a speaker system. And I don't know where in the world I came up with it, but I thought it would be a good idea to tell a joke every day. And it became the North House joke of the day. And it kind of trailed me around. I still run into people I went to high school with who laugh about that. Probably don't laugh about the jokes, but laugh about the idea of doing that. So it was a lot of fun to do, though. I grew up in a great place, too. I knew you're from the East End. I grew up just north of New York City in Westchester County at White Plains High School. And I still have good friends all these years later from White Plains. My best friend from seventh grade is still my best friend in life. He lives a mile and a half away. We play golf at the same place. You know, his kids call me Uncle Jimmy. My kids call him Uncle Rob. It's just nothing like old friends.
Yeah, one of those special relationships that you really truly blessed if you have those in your life. Let me ask you, Jimmy Roberts, our special guest, and we're thrilled to have him here on Musings. You worked under Howard Cosell. How did that come to be, and how did that help shape your writing skills?
You know, I don't know that it helped shape my writing skills. There were other people that I worked with during those days at ABC Sports and ABC News who really helped shape my writing skills. Jim McKay, Dick Schaap, a correspondent, a guy named Judd Rose, who I thought was a brilliant writer for a couple of years when I worked at ABC News. But one thing that I learned from Howard, that I took from working for Howard, was it always amazed me that he was able to ask pointed, challenging questions and not lose the people that he was talking to. And I know that a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was kind of larger than life. And in many cases, in most cases, he was a much, much bigger deal than the people he was interviewing. But still, he had a way of asking the question that needed to be asked, even if it was uncomfortable. And it always, it all those years later, it put in my mind that as a journalist, that's your job, is to ask what people on the couch want to know, not what people in the locker room want to hear. It doesn't always make you popular, but as long as you can treat people with respect, and that's your job. And so that's what I took from Howard. And, you know, it's funny. It's just so amazing to me. I truly believe that Howard was probably the biggest name in the history of television sports. And today, you know, there are just plenty of people, the majority, I would think, who don't even know who he was. A couple of years ago, I was in Austin, Texas. We go there every year to do the match play, the PGA Tour, the Dell Technologies match play event in Austin. And a friend of mine from my days back at ABC now teaches a class at UT. And he invited me to come in and talk to his class. I actually have done it several times. And one time I went in to speak to the students, and my friend Joel is asking me to just tell the class a little bit about my background, how I got started. And I started to summarize what I'd done. And at one point I mentioned, you know, and at one point I worked for Howard Cosell for a couple of years on a show called Sports Beat, which was a half an hour show. And I write and produce features for him. And as I'm saying this, I'm looking around the room and I'm getting blank stares. Now, these are all kids who want to go into sports media. That's what they're in the class for. And I kind of stopped myself in sentence and I said, let me just see a show of hands in here. Who among you has heard of Howard Cosell? And if there were 100 kids in the class, I think there maybe 15 of them raised their hand. So, I mean, that was just such a lesson for me, you know, about how kind of fleeting the nature of accomplishment in our society is. Like, you know, there are a lot of people who've never, and I think more people remember him, but people who've never heard of or don't know who Walter Cronkite was, you know, it amazes me. So anyway, that's kind of a little bit of a tangent there, but from Howard, I learned that your job is to get the answers and try your best to maintain good relationships, but your job is to find out what people want to know.
And Jimmy, I would presume that's guided you to this day in terms of how you approach any kind of interview on any kind of subject. Is that fair?
Yeah, and Kelly, it absolutely has. I mean, if I'm being totally frank, my biggest criticism of our industry is that I think people who do what we do for a living sometimes struggle to find the right balance between being cordial and doing their jobs. You know, I think a lot of times people are more interested in kind of forging relationships with people. And don't get me wrong, you know, nobody wants, everybody wants to be liked. But I just think that the real challenge is to try and find a way to respectfully, and it isn't every question, but I think that, you know, it's to ask, you know, at the times when a question needs to be asked, ask the question. And, you know, it's not like every topic is going to be confrontational. It's not like everything needs to be confrontational. But the fact of the matter is, if you're talking to somebody, let's say in golf, if you're talking to somebody who just has blown a tournament. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example of somebody who I thought did a wonderful job. So at the PGA Championship, as we record this, I guess it was last week, Mito Pereira, you know, I mean, let's be candid. I mean, that tournament was, that trophy was his to take home. But he had a bad drive on 18, maybe made a bad choice. And I thought Amanda Renner did a really, really good job of kind of respectfully and compassionately raising the topic, but still dealing with it. That's your job, you know? And the challenge of the job is to try and find a way to talk about the things sometimes that you don't, you know, people may not want to talk about, but certainly people who are watching want to hear about. Do you think there is anything else in the world that people wanted to hear from Mito Pereira about his state of mind on the 18th tee? You know, maybe there were actually plenty of other things, but that was topic one, and she did a great job of getting to it.
Yeah, I want to jump in, Kelly, just for a minute, because speaking of great jobs, and I watched numerous interviews by Jimmy Roberts with Arnold Palmer, and I always came away with the one thought, boy, Arnie really enjoyed talking to Jimmy. And I got a sense from you, and I've never discussed this with you, Jimmy. It seemed like, obviously, you took great pride in sitting there, you know, at Bay Hill, being able to talk to Arnold Palmer.
Well, Bob, thank you. First and foremost, Arnold was a very, very special man. I mean, you knew him. Kelly, I don't know if you did. I'm kind of guessing you must have.
I did.
But, yeah, I mean, so, you know, for listeners who aren't aware, because time passes so quickly, and it's been, what, 6 years now, I think?
Yep.
Since
yep.
Arnie passed. So for many years at Bay Hill, there's a building that's still there called Lexington Cottage, and I would be stationed down there, and Arnold would come in, and he'd sit down. And a couple of times during the telecast, Arnold and I would kind of just chat, and I would, you know, interview him. And it was truly one of the great privileges of my professional career, my life, to have had an opportunity to develop a relationship with a guy like Arnold, not because, you know, he was such a great golfer, but because he was such a great guy and was so influential. You know, the old cliche is that 10,000 people went to a tournament, and every single one of them will tell you that when Arnold looked up in the stands, he looked directly at them. Arnold was a great man because he grew up the son of a greenkeeper in Western Pennsylvania. And despite the fact that he attained, you know, massive stardom, international stardom, he never really changed. I never, ever saw Arnie big time anybody. And, you know, it's just a reflection is that I hear a lot of people refer to him as Mr. Palmer. And I can't tell you I know this for sure. But there's just something inside. I never called him that. He was always Arnold to me. And I think it was because I think that's what he wanted. You know, I think he wanted to be regarded as Arnold. He didn't want to be deified. He was so good to people. You know, everybody knows the fact that if you've ever seen his autograph, you can read it. And his reasoning was that he wanted people to know that if they took the time to ask him for his autograph, if they felt that way about him, he wanted them to be able to read it. And that just is, there's so much about him that was so terrific. I'll just tell you a real quick story. I don't know even know how many years ago it was. I wrote my first book about, it was called Breaking the Slump, how great players survived their worst times in the game and what you can learn from it. And it was basically 20 chapters, a prologue and an epilogue sandwiched around 18 chapters, each of which focus on one player, 16 PGA Tour and LPGA Tour players who had fallen into horrible slumps, as well as one Olympic gold medalist and one U.S. president, George H.W. Bush. But when the project, the literary agent, and I first started discussing it, he said to me, well, you need to write a sample chapter. And I'd never written a book before, so I had no idea what I was doing. He said, you need to write a sample chapter, and you need to write a sample chapter with somebody who will demonstrate to the publisher that this is going to be worthy of buying. And so I just had to think about it. And based on my relationship with Arnold, I went to him and I said, Arnold, I've got this idea about writing a book, and I'm wondering, I haven't sold it to anybody, but would you spend some time with me and write a chapter with me? There wasn't a 1 second hesitation. He said, absolutely, Jimmy. So we wrote that chapter together. And on the basis of that, we not only sold the book, but the book became the object of a bidding war. And it's not to say that, you know, it wasn't because people wanted to read what I had to say. It was because people were intrigued by the fact that Arnold Palmer would have been involved. And not only was Arnold Palmer involved, but with each subsequent person that I went to ask if they would participate, the question was, well, who else is doing it? Well, Arnold's doing it. I only have one person say no. I won't tell you who that person is. Use your imagination. But, you know, the other players, Jack Nicklaus did a chapter with me. Like I said, George Herbert Walker Bush did a chapter with me. Dan Jansen, Olympic gold medalist. Ben Crenshaw, Davis Love, Dottie Pepper. The point is all of those people, I think, were reacting to the fact, well, it's good enough for Arnold, it's good enough for me. So, I mean, I could go on and on and on about my feelings about Arnold Palmer. But he was a very, very special man, and I felt privileged to have had a relationship with him.
You know, Jimmy Roberts joining us. As you talk about Arnold, his influence, certainly you mentioned even someone like Dan Jansen, people outside of golf being influenced by Arnold, et cetera. I was struck, Peter King, it was probably about 10 years or so ago, Jimmy, he was at the Ravens training camp. Ed Reed was signing autographs going through the at the end of the day. And obviously Ed Reed is not a long name, but he noticed how beautifully he was signing. And he asked him about it. He said, well, I learned it from Arnold Palmer. He said, I don't know whether he had gotten an autograph from Arnold at one point, but he said, no different from Arnold signing. He said, when I sign, I want people to remember that it was Ed Reed who signed it. Pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, Arnold had a lot of influence in a lot of different places. And, you know, it's funny, I saw his daughter Amy and her husband Roy at a charity event I did last week. And we spent a bunch of time together. And I keep on thinking about the thing with Arnold was he was kind, and there was a kindness about the man. And I'll tell you, there's nothing we could use more these days than kindness.
Couldn't agree with you more. I've got to ask you something about, so you've won 11 Emmys in your career, or at least at ESPN. Were there any certain events, certain people that stood out above others during your time there in winning those 11 moments, people that are sort of at the top of what you remember?
You know, Kelly, I'll tell you, I've been very fortunate to have had the opportunity to work with some extraordinary people over the years. I was really lucky to go and work at ESPN at a time, you know, I'd never been on television before. I was behind the scenes as a writer and producer. And I went to ESPN at a time and it was on the job training for me. And I was awful for my first couple of years on the air. And I think there are probably a lot of people who still think I haven't moved very far off of that mark. But I was really lucky to work there and have some great opportunities. But one, to answer your question, one stands out. My producer, David Brodsky and I, or two, I'll say two. My producer, David Brodsky and I, I want to say it was 1991. I guess you're going to have to look this up on Google. When was Desert Storm? We were sent over to the Middle East to do a bunch of stories on how sports impacts the military. And, I mean, this is really basically the first time the United States had been at war since, I guess, Vietnam, unless I'm missing something.
No, it was.
But, that opportunity, the 2 weeks we spent in the Middle East, the people we met, I'm the son of a man who served in the Second World War, wounded and decorated. So I have extraordinary heightened respect for people who choose to defend our country. Anyway, to be there was just really moving. And to this day, we were assigned a PAO, public affairs officer, a Navy commander by the name of Greg Slavonic. Now, that's how many years ago? 22, 30 years ago. To this day, Greg Slavonic and I are still friends. He went on to become an admiral and served in the Pentagon as the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Or Undersecretary of Defense. So it's all about the people. And the other story is that I had been assigned, still one of the assignments that I really stands out in my mind. I don't even remember the year, but Riddick Bowe was the heavyweight boxing champion of the world back at a time when to be the heavyweight boxing champion was to be one of the biggest celebrities in sports. Riddick Bowe, who was a colorful character, had decided that he wanted to lead a relief mission to South Africa and Soweto. And so he funded, gathered together humanitarian supplies, food and medical supplies, and he paid for a C-130 transport plane to take them over from the United States, filled up the plane to take them over from the United States. And it was the power of the heavyweight champion that he could solicit these types of contributions to fill a plane with these types of supplies. Anyway, he funded a plane to take them over, and I was assigned to go with him on this trip. So it was... he was going to South Africa, where he met with Nelson Mandela, and then he went to Mogadishu in Somalia. And it was during the time of Black Hawk Down in the United States' military involvement there. And then from there, he went to the Vatican, where he met with the Pope. So, and I tagged along with him with a camera crew. And, I mean, that trip was just so incredibly memorable. I mean, all of the stories, but you asked me about people who stand out. Let me just relate this. And this is probably around the same time. I'm thinking this has got to be early 90s. And again, my apologies for not having an exact time context. But one of the things that I will never forget, for as long as I live, is a woman by the name of Valerie Place. So we had been in Soweto and spent the time there with Nelson Mandela, touring the townships. And then we flew on a commercial plane from Johannesburg to Nairobi, Kenya. And from Nairobi, we were to board a military transport to go into Somalia. So we flew into Somalia, and before we got off the plane, we all had to put on helmets and bulletproof, you know, flak jackets. And we were put in the back of an armed Humvee and taken, to the military base in Mogadishu. And I'm telling you, you know, it's a pretty bracing experience to be in a situation like that, you know, where you look up and there's a machine, you know, a Marine machine gun, right above your shoulder, you know, scanning the streets as you roll down and into the military base. So anyway, we went into the military base, and the next day we flew out of that military base to a grass airstrip in a distant place called Mandera. And he landed this plane on a grass airstrip, and we went to some of these encampments where this humanitarian aid, these humanitarian supplies were delivered. Well, while we were there, we had obviously a big armed escort because it was the heavyweight champion of the world. And we came across a volunteer from the Irish Aid Agency, a woman who was a nurse. Her name was Valerie Place. And, you know, we videotaped the meeting and everything, and they were so grateful that Riddick Bowe had come and delivered these much needed supplies. We went one way and she went the other way. And a half an hour later, we got word over the radio that her convoy had been ambushed and she had been killed. And I get, you know, chills right now as I tell the story, because I think to myself, you know, just seeing her face and how happy she was and how selfless she was and, you know, dedicating her life to helping people so far from home. And then her life was over. So I'll never forget her. Just moments like that that have made, you know, me realize how fortunate I am in so many ways.
Let's turn a little bit positive, Jimmy. I've been blessed to have gotten to know you over the years covering golf, and always wanted to ask you, what is it about golf that appeals to you so much?
Well, you know, it was kind of an accident that I kind of became involved in golf. I mean, I'm not at my best. I was like a 9 index or something like that. But so I'm not very good, but I love the game to play. But it goes back to my time at ABC and ESPN. When I was at ABC, I just happened to get assigned to covering golf. Not covering golf. I was the production assistant on the golf crew with, you know, doing the graphics. And I started out as a gopher, a runner, you know, somebody at the very, very entry level, but I was assigned to the golf tour. And it was such a great experience getting to know people like Dave Marr, Jim McKay, Peter Alice, all the people. I still have close relationships to this day with people I worked with on that golf tour 40 years ago. And so then when I went to ESPN, I was just a, you know, general sports center reporter. And they had people who had different beats. You know, there were people who covered base, and this was long before the days of the specialty shows. I mean, all there was SportsCenter. So SportsCenter would send, you know, somebody to cover the World Series and somebody to cover tennis, you know, when the big events happen. And I was looking around and I had to try and figure, you know, now I covered a little bit of everything, but I had to figure, well, I think that the way to be successful here is to kind of stake out some territory. And I thought, well, I had relationships in the game of golf, not many, but some. And I thought I, you know, had a familiarity with the way major championship golf tournaments were conducted. So I thought, I suggested, hey, why don't, you know, we're not covering golf. How about letting me cover golf? So I think the reaction was lukewarm at first, but, you know, I did, you know, they sent somebody to the Masters every year. So they sent me to the Masters, and then it, you know, we sporadically covered golf for the next couple of years, and then Tiger Woods happened and we covered everything golf. And I was the guy because I had been doing it. And when I was hired at NBC in 2000, Dick Ebersole told me that he wanted me to cover golf and to do the Olympics, two things that I had probably the most experience with. And so I'd done that and had a great opportunity to do a bunch of other stuff too.
You mentioned the Olympics, Jimmy Roberts joining us on Musings on Sports. Jimmy, you've covered 17 Olympic Games. What's it like reporting on such a global stage? Are there certain challenges, particularly with so many sports going on all at once?
Well, it's just TV. You know, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I mean, I enjoy it, but it's just, you know, another story, another competition. Now, I say that not to denigrate the Olympics or diminish their significance, but I mean, that's just the way you have to go about it. You've got to, you know, you got to cover the Little League World Series like you cover the Olympic Games. I mean, I think you should. You got to do everything seriously. It's just, you know, there are a few more eyeballs watching. I mean, I think I remember I've had a lot of great experiences at the Olympics, but I think one that I look back on is in 2002, when the Olympics were in Salt Lake City, I was given the task, the honor of being the person to interview the person or people who were to light the Olympic flame. And, you know, if you think back on that, it was only several months after 9/11, the country was really wounded. The spirit of the country was really wounded. And here was a, you know, a domestic Olympics, and the president, George Bush, was there. He came to the opening ceremony, sat with the Olympic athletes, the American athletes in the stands. And I was told ahead of time so that I could prepare that the torch was going to be lit by the Miracle on Ice team. And so there I was stationed at the top of the stadium in Salt Lake City, and 80,000 people in the stadium, you know, this festival, feel good festival, and everybody just feeling great. And then the torch ran up the steps. I don't remember who the second to last torchbearer was, but then out from the wings pour all the guys from the Miracle on Ice team in their jerseys, and the crowd went absolutely crazy. And I just remember standing up there interviewing Mike Ruzioni and Jim Craig and kind of looking out at this sea of flashbulbs going off and not really being able to see very much out there. But I do remember having the thought that there were, you know, 80,000 people in the stadium, but hundreds of millions around the world watching. And that is really the only time that I can tell you that I ever was cognizant of the fact that there were a lot of people watching what I was doing. You know, it's just, that was a really significant moment. I get the chills from thinking about it. But, you know, other than that, you know, you do what you do. You know, you always try and do your best, be prepared, be organized, work hard, and treat everything like it's the Olympic Games.
Well, you certainly have handled your career that way. Before we let you go, Jimmy, I know recently you worked on a book with the great Mark Messier. I think it's called No One Wins Alone. How'd that book, tell us how that book got started, and what did you learn about him in this memoir?
Well, you know what? It's so funny, Bob. That book came about because of golf. Mark and I have a mutual friend, and we were introduced, and we played a bunch of golf together. And Mark actually read my first book. Mark's a big reader, and he read my first book, and he said to me, you know, people have been after me to write a book forever, but I've never wanted to do it, and I want to write a book on leadership, and I was wondering if you would write a book with me. And so we dove into it, and he's a fascinating guy. I mean, I had much respect for him to begin with, but once I got to know him and who he really was and what he's about, you know, that respect just multiplied. He's an extraordinary hockey player, of course. He's the only person to have ever captained two different NHL teams to a Stanley Cup title, six Stanley Cups. You know, what people don't remember is that he won the four in Edmonton with Gretzky, but then he won one in Edmonton after Wayne had been traded to the Kings, and then, of course, the one in 1994 with the Rangers, so six Stanley Cups. But it's not only about winning. It's about the way he approaches winning and going about his business and the respect that he has for, you know, the people he plays with. And just one real quick story, because I know I'm kind of going on and on, but I think the listeners will appreciate this. So Mark, when he played for the Rangers, they were playing one year, and I've forgotten whether this was the year they won the Stanley Cup or before, but the point was they were down a player. They needed to bring up somebody from the farm club. And so they called up a fellow by the name of Darren Langdon. And Darren was from, I believe, Nova Scotia. And, you know, they were going to, he was going to join the team in Montreal. So here's this guy who'd never played in the NHL, had been raised in rural Canada. And he was going to go and play his first NHL game in the most famous arena in the game, the Montreal Forum. And he was going to go play with the great New York Rangers of Messier and Brian Leetch and Mike Richter and Alex Kovalev. I mean, just the people who are dominating the game. He shows up at the arena, and the Rangers at the time had a rule that when you came to the arena, you had to wear jacket and tie. Well, Langdon shows up, and he's wearing khakis and a sweater. And a bunch of the guys on the team are laughing at him, and Mark said, "Don't laugh at him." He said, "This may be the best that this guy's got." And so what Mark did was called up a guy he knew in Montreal who was a tailor, had him come to the hotel and custom fit Darren Langdon for a suit. Langdon showed up that night for the game, or I forget if it was the game or the skate the day before, I'm not sure. But he shows up and there's a custom-made Hugo Boss suit in his locker. First suit he's ever owned. Well, of course, what does he do? In the game, Darren Langdon scores a goal and the Rangers win. So here's the moral of the story. If you have somebody who's part of your team, don't you want them to feel as good about themselves as they possibly can? If they're your teammate and you need them, you want them to feel good so that they can do well. And I just thought that's just such a simple lesson, but it's something that is so often ignored. There's no cost. I mean, for Mark, there was a cost, but there's really no cost for most employers, you know, to make their employees feel good about themselves, because when they do, they'll do a better job. And that's why Messier is such a great leader and always has been. Just little things like that. And that's why it was such a pleasure spending the year or so that we spent, you know, every week, hours and hours, either in my kitchen or in his, you know, talking. He's a fascinating guy. I really love writing the book.
Our guest is Jimmy Roberts. I'm going to cram in a quick story about Mark Messier. I was in Ireland, and I got an opportunity to play Doonbeg, but it was quite a ways from where I was staying. So arrangements were made that they would take me there, and Janice Self, as you know, Jimmy, our executive producer, in a helicopter to Doonbeg. So we go out, and we play, and we're finished and we're sitting on the patio, and I look over and I said to Janice, that's Mark Messier. He had a group of golfers. They had just played Doonbeg, and all of a sudden Mark says, "Come on, guys, we got to get going. That bus is going to be here any minute now." And just as he said that, I hear this whoop, whoop, whoop. So I stand up and I said, "Janice, come on. Our helicopter is going to be here any second. We got to get going." Mark Messier's head almost snapped off of his neck. Who the heck is this guy coming by helicopter? But everything I've ever heard about Mark Messier echoes what you just said, Jimmy. A very, very, very special talent, obviously on the ice, but a wonderful human being to boot.
And, you know, Bob, he's a pilot, flies his own plane, too. He's probably looking over when that helicopter came, thinking to himself, "Man, I'd like to get in the left seat on that thing."
Well, I'll tell you what, Jimmy, as we close, I know you and the entire NBC Sports golf team got to be anxious to get to the U.S. Open at the Country Club outside of Boston before a huge gallery. It's been, you know, like so many things, it's been a strange couple of years. I'm sure it's going to be an absolute thrill to hear those roars once again at a major golf championship, at our national championship.
Well, Kelly, I got to tell you something. It's really an unusual year. You could make the case that the two Open championships, the U.S. Open and the Open Championship, are being played at the two most important places in golf. I mean, of course, St. Andrews this year, the birthplace of golf, 150th Open. But the Country Club, which I think it's, you know, undeniable. It's the birthplace of American golf because of what Francis Ouimet did there in 1913. So, I mean, it's going to be a great year. It already is a great year. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Jimmy Roberts, we thank you immensely for your time, your wonderful insights, some incredibly compelling stories. And I know I speak for Bob in wishing you and the team at NBC Sports the very best for the U.S. Open coming up, and continued success in your career. And thank you. Thank you so much. Jimmy Roberts joining us on Musings on Sports.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Bob, as I said going into that interview, I've always been a big fan of Jimmy Roberts. Great storyteller, hardworking guy. You see him on a lot of events for NBC Sports. I just think he's terrific, and I thought he told some wonderful stories in that interview.
Yeah, it really was a pleasure and an honor to have Jimmy Roberts with us on Musing on Sports, and we certainly hope, and I'm pretty sure they did, our listeners enjoyed hearing from the one, the only Jimmy Roberts.
Well, thanks, Bob. Great to be with you as always. A reminder to all of you out there listening to join us next week as we prepare for the United States Open Golf Championship, which will feature, as we noted earlier, both Dustin Johnson and Phil Mickelson, but not Tiger Woods, to be played at the Country Club outside of Boston. Encourage all of you to please check out my Monday Musings. It's Kelly Elbin on my Facebook page. And please enjoy Musings on Sports wherever you enjoy your podcast. For my dear friend Bob Bupka, soon to be headed off to the old country, this is Kelly Elbin signing off. Thanks for listening to Musings on Sports.